Hey friends, it's Julie. Just before we jump into this episode, I want to let you know that we had some technical difficulties with the recording. So my audio is going to sound a little muffled throughout the conversation, but I think you'll really enjoy hearing it. So we wanted to share it. Bear with the slightly different sound quality, and I cannot wait to hear your thoughts about the content of the episode. And while we're here, I do want to just let you know as well that we'll be touching briefly on the topic of suicide about halfway through the episode. Okay, let's go.
If I had known how hard it would be, I might not have done it. When you have all of the kind of emotion that I had pent up for 35, 40 years, it's terribly difficult, but I had a lot of support.
Hey, it's Julie. Welcome to Uncomfy, a show about sticking with moments that challenge us. You know, every day I encounter ideas or people or situations that make me uncomfortable. Not in the I'm in danger kind of way, but more like, I really disagree, or this is way outside my comfort zone. But if I bail out or lash out right away, I might miss a chance to learn something or feel new empathy or deepen a relationship. So the question is how, right? Well, that is what this podcast is about. Real people telling real stories of choosing to stay open and curious in challenging moments. I'm glad you're here. Now, let's get uncomfy. What if getting really uncomfortable could help heal a deep emotional wound? I'm joined by Constance Scharf. She's a mental health researcher and director of the Human Resilience Project. She just spent the last year doing research in 7 different countries for a book that she's working on about everyday bravery and resilience. Dr. Scharf, welcome. I'm so glad to have you.
Thank you for having me.
I would love to hear about a place or a situation you've traveled to recently that challenged you in maybe in a good way or maybe not. Something challenging.
Well, that's really what I do is make myself go into uncomfortable situations. That's sort of the crux of my work. But on this last research tour in Turkey, I had the opportunity to go on a food tour. And we went to, 8 or 10 different places to try different kinds of foods, both on the Asian side of Istanbul and the European side. And I'm Jewish, so it's really not acceptable to eat not kosher foods. But I did this on purpose because I wanted to go and meet people that I wouldn't normally eat with. And I ended up on a tour with a Tunisian father and daughter. And it was so interesting because if he didn't understand the English, the tour guide would tell him in Arabic because she was Muslim, so she knew Arabic. And I'd say, oh, if it's that in Arabic, it's this in Hebrew. And we formed such a bond. It was so fun. But I wouldn't have had that experience if I wasn't willing to break the rules and go on this food tour.
Break the rules meaning you ate some stuff that you weren't supposed to eat, or
well,
just to be
kosher.
There?
It's not in a kosher kitchen.
Yeah. I will say some of the very best fish I've ever had was caught right there in the Bosphorus River in Istanbul and then grilled on a little like charcoal grill right by the river and served up with a delicious piece of pita or some kind of bread. I don't know.
It's food in Istanbul is unbelievable.
Amen.
It is so good and so fresh. Loved it.
Yeah, yeah. And I do think that traveling is sort of the ultimate opportunity to get uncomfortable and in order to learn. And I know that makes a lot of people really nervous. And it's one of the things I'm constantly encouraging is go someplace that feels really foreign because there is nothing like what you will learn from yourself about yourself when you're in an environment where you can't kind of lean on all the crutches, like everybody's going to understand what I say, or I know how the metro system works here.
Well, and you can't expect it to be. This is one of the problems that Americans have traveling is they go, you know, overseas and expect it to be like it is here. For example, ice. And cold drinks is not a thing.
They don't put ice in their Coke. I'm always like, I need ice in my soda.
Yeah, you know, and so, or water. Other places do not drink water with their meals. They're not going to bring you water. Like, water's not a thing. And so, I want I want to know how you live. And so I immerse myself in those situations, not expecting you, and I think this is important, not expecting you to make me comfortable.
So you, I saw somewhere that you had once been referred to as the Indiana Jones of mental health research, going to far-flung places, which is such an image. What is it that you are seeking when you are traveling as a researcher? What are you looking for when it comes to mental health?
So I'm looking for the commonalities between communities of what we do kind of globally. I've been on every inhabited continent. And one of the things we've learned is that storytelling is used in every culture that I've been with. Now, it looks different, but there is an emphasis on changing our internal dialogue, the stories that we tell ourselves, and very often the stories that our communities tell about us. For example, with storytelling, if someone is depressed, now, in indigenous communities, they cannot let depression get to the point that we do in the West, where you cannot get out of bed because you'll die. This community can't support that. So as soon as someone starts seeing these indications, most of the time the communities will all come together and they will sing and dance and clap and syncopate and tell stories about how wonderful and necessary you are. And they do that until your internal dialogue, because a lot of depression is this internal dialogue of the world is better off without me, I can't do anything, I'm in a, that's a lot of what's going on, until that internal dialogue changes. So that's really what I'm looking at. And it's fascinating to me because I go to very, very remote communities. It takes days sometimes to get there. And I'm like, I'm really interested in how you live. And that's usually when they're willing to share with me.
So I would love to hear a story from you.
Yeah.
Because I know that your work is inspired by your personal experience overcoming trauma and addiction.
Sure. So in the academy, they call that me search rather than research. So this is very common that the research we become involved in comes from our personal experience. So I come from an extremely abusive childhood from which I developed complex post-traumatic stress, CPTSD. It's what it's called. Very extreme sexual trauma. So much so that for 3 years, this happened from 7 to 10. And the 3 years that the abuse was happening, I have almost full amnesia. So it was very extreme. Out of that, trying to cope with it, I started drinking at 11 and was a full-blown alcoholic, drinking 2 liters of hard liquor or more a day by the time I was 22 and my organs were failing. I was starting to die. Because the PTSD symptoms, the body memories, the flashbacks, the hypervigilance, all that stuff, they were so overwhelming and so painful that I knew intuitively that alcohol would make me feel numb. In the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, they talk about drinking for oblivion. That's where I was. I wanted to feel nothing. But I got a break. And the break was when I was 22 years old. My father died.
Your father was your abuser.
My father was my abuser. And I realized that the drinking was a problem because he was dead, but I was still drinking the same amount, if not a little bit more. And so I was like, I'm going to die for him. And that made me want to get sober. And so I got into recovery. And finally, 26 and a half years ago now, I was sort of struck sober. But what I found was that the trauma didn't go away. And so I was always sort of mildly suicidal, very depressed, overwhelmed by trauma, but in recovery from addiction for 10 years.
So nothing to numb it then.
Nothing to numb it. And back at that time, there was not good treatment for trauma. There is now. So I was in a mutual aid society, a 12-step group, and I started seeing our veterans coming back from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And they were not getting sober. And one of the veterans, who I really, really liked, a very young man, 23 years old, ended up killing himself. And when he died, I got really angry. I was studying something else in graduate school. I got really angry and I changed everything I was doing in grad school. And I went into this very deep dive into addiction and trauma treatment. And when I got out of grad school, when I got my doctorate, I was employed by a leading addiction treatment facility. And the owner at that time, he said, I want to find out what the complementary therapies are so that we have a better outcome in the treatment facility. So this could include anything from nutrition and exercise all the way up to somatic experiencing, music therapies, narratives and storytelling, which I shifted into later. So all of these things are complementary that go with Western psychological talk therapies.
Interesting. Okay. And one of the things that this led you to is somatic therapy. And this is the thing that ultimately has worked for you. So describe what it is.
So somatic experiencing, I had read about it a little bit in Vander Kolk's The Body Keeps the Score. And that is really the fundamental or foundational text about somatics. But his idea is that the body holds on to trauma. So when we have a traumatic experience, it's actually stored really physiologically in the body. And so I was introduced to something called radical aliveness. And your practitioner, they're not a therapist, your practitioner will work with you to help you move the trauma through. They want to keep you moving. And I don't want to move. I want to be stock still watching. I want to curl my feet up underneath me and I want to be dissociated. I want to have my consciousness sort of up here or way, way back behind my eyes. I don't.
That's your trauma response. That's how you're coping with it. Okay.
Yeah. Right? I want to not really be here. And the somatic practitioner says, no, no, we're going to be in our body. So very often they'll have you sort of dance and wiggle and move around. And I'm like, you're a freak show. So we had to really titrate for me. I would say I probably spent a month, maybe longer, where my whole session was, no, 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 stay here. I see you're leaving. Stay here. And I'd really have to fight just to be present. And they would say to me very often, what are you feeling? What am I feeling? Like in my body? Nothing. I don't know.
So the therapy then required you to feel your feelings.
It allows you. See, I right. wasn't capable of it. They'd say to me, what are you feeling? I was trying. I don't know. I had to learn. Literally, I would say to the practitioner, I feel something. Okay, is it in your body or is it an emotion? Okay, I could tell the difference between, you know, my feet are cold and I'm angry, right? I could tell that difference. But I'd be like, okay, no, it's an emotion. And then she would help me identify and she'd say, oh, okay, could it be belligerence? Could it be, you know, frustration? Could it be? And I'd be like, no. Oh, yes, I think it's that. Okay. And then we would reach into, okay, well, where is that in your body?
So was this a comfortable experience?
No, it's horrible.
Okay.
It's horrible. It's horrible. No, in fact, I want to be honest about it. If I had known how hard it would be, I might not have done it. It's hard. When you have all of the kind of emotion that I had pent up for 35, 40 years, just strangling me? No, it's terribly difficult, but I had a lot of support.
Yeah. And so you said that today you've been 2 years without any of those PTSD symptoms.
I cannot, as an individual, it's mind blowing, the experience. As a researcher. I don't have an explanation for this. Others who have done radical aliveness or similar things have said similar things. But one of my frustrations is that there are a lot of therapeutics that are very effective and they're not covered by insurance, so people don't have access to them. And that's one of the reasons why I write popular press books rather than academic articles. I focus that way specifically so that the public can have access to this and find out, how do you get access? So one way of doing a different type of somatic is yoga. Not the yoga you do at the yoga studio at the gym. That is, has been disconnected from its Indian roots. But yoga, when it's connected to its traditional base, is also very effective as a somatic clearing series of exercises. And when I say exercises, I don't mean just calisthenics.
I mean, because it's so much tied to the breathing and staying present in your body.
Exactly. It is a biopsychosocial, physical, mental, spiritual, right? It hits on all levels when I say exercises. Yeah.
It's so interesting, Constance Scharf. It certainly resonates with me, having not experienced anything traumatic or any trauma symptoms, but lifelong anxiety and mood disorder, that it was only about 5 or 6 years ago that I was just feeling like rage all the time and anger and fear and sadness. And I was like, well, talk therapy is not doing it. Antidepressants are not helping as much as I wish they would. So I did a mindfulness meditation training where we did a lot of breathing. And I was, you know, that very first session where the practitioner, our leader, talked about how we're just going to sit and feel whatever and like notice whatever comes to mind and sort of feel those feelings. And I was like, hang on a second, that's going to just sweep me over the, you know, the waterfall right into the abyss. Like, that sounds terrible. I'm here to learn how to silence it, you know, like that's what I thought meditation was silencing, and realizing that I just had to sit in the discomfort of these unpleasant thoughts and emotions and sort of let them wash past was deeply counterintuitive and also pretty miraculous.
But
when I could finally do it.
That's what I'm talking about when I say that there are these lines, that these threads that pull through the different cultures. We've been taught in the West, fix it, numb it, get rid of it. Whereas the indigenous cultures and non-Western cultures will be like, no, you have to feel it. And if you don't, it just stays with you. And if we can give ourselves up to the idea that we just have a wide range of experience and learn how to be present, we can do very, very well.
Constance Scharf is an award-winning mental health researcher and director of the Human Resilience Project. You can learn more about her work on her website, constancescharf.com, and be watching for that book to come out in 2026 about everyday bravery. Thank you for sharing your insights and your time with us today.
Thank you.
And thank you for getting uncomfy with us today. I would love to hear about an uncomfy moment you've had recently where you chose to maybe engage with someone you disagree with or get outside your comfort zone or maybe just sit with the discomfort of some tough feedback or some tough emotions. How did it go for you? What difference has it made for you? Let me know. Email uncomfy@byu.edu. And in the meantime, make sure to check out my other podcast, Top of Mind, where we tackle tough topics in a way that will challenge you but also help you feel more empathy. And it's a great way to practice sticking with discomfort in your everyday life. Just look for Top of Mind with Julie Rose on your podcast platform of choice. Uncomfy is a BYU radio podcast. Samuel Benson produces it, and the team includes Enrique Prado, James Hoops, and Sam Payne. Our theme music was composed by Kelsey Ney. I'm Julie Rose. Can't wait to get uncomfy with you again next week.
It's Julie. Hey, one quick thing to mention to you. I would love to recommend a podcast called In Good Faith. It's from the BYU Radio family of podcasts. It's hosted by Stephen Cap Perry. And this show is all about connecting with believers from various religions. On Uncomfy, we're looking to have hard conversations, and it doesn't get harder than talking about religion when you have different traditions and beliefs. And this podcast is just so cool because Stephen talks with people about their own personal faith journeys, people from all walks of life, Christians, Buddhists, Jews, Muslims, many, many more. And it's a chance to hear their stories in their own words. And I always come away with a deeper understanding both of their faith and of my own faith in listening to these conversations. Plus, Stephen's just a really well-traveled guy, so his unique global perspective adds this really great richness to every conversation. So check out In Good Faith. You can listen on all the podcast apps, and I'd love to hear what you think about it.